Fitz looks at me.
Then go, he says.
His easy answer is enough to bring me up short. Why aren't you talking me out of it?
Why should I, Fitz says. Your father isn't going anywhere anytime soon, and he'd be the first one to tell you to get on with your life. Sophie would do better back in New Hampshire, in an environment she's used to. It's not like you have to stick around to get to know your mother.
What's that supposed to mean?
True or false, you don't care whether or not you see her again.
True, I want to say, except I can't. I thought I'd come here and it would all make sense, I say, wiping my eyes with the hem of my t-shirt. I just wish I could remember it all.
Why?
No one has asked me that question yet. Well, because I don't know who I used to be, I say.
I do. Eric does. Christ, Delia, you have 100 witnesses to help you with that. If you really want something to worry about, try figuring out who you're going to be from now on. He bends his knees and rolls onto his side. You want to know what I think?
Would you stop if I said no?
I think you're angry at your mother for losing you in the first place.
Grudgingly, I nod.
And you're angry at your father for taking you.
Well?
But most of all, I think you're angry at yourself for not being smart enough to figure this all out on your own, Fitz says.
So what if you lived in New Hampshire instead of Arizona? What's important is where you'll be living 5 years from now. So what if you had some lemon tree growing in your backyard? I'd rather know if you want to plant one in your garden now. So what if you have some crazy fear of spiders? That's what hypnosis is for.
He reaches out and pulls on one of my braids. If you don't want someone to change your life for you again, Dee, you've got to change it yourself.
At that moment, everything comes clear. It's like having someone walk up to a chalky window that you've been trying to see through for days and wiping it clean. Some people have a detailed history. Others don't. There are plenty of adopted children who grow up without knowing an ounce of information about their birth parents. There are criminals who walk out of jail and become pillars of the community. At any moment, a person can start over. And that's not half a life, but simply a real one. It is also a terrifying prospect that the relationships we use as the cornerstones of our personalities are not given by default, but are a choice. That it's all right to feel closer to a friend than we do to a parent. That someone who's betrayed us in the past might be the same person with whom we build a future. I lean back against the wall of the car, dizzy.
You make it sound so easy. And you make it more complicated than it has to be, Fitz counters. Bottom line, do you love your father?
Yes, I say quickly.
Do you love your mother?
He wouldn't let me.
Fitz shakes his head. Delia, he corrects. He couldn't stop you.
I watch Greta's breathing even out in sleep. Maybe I'll stay a little longer, I say.
This ends Disc 8. Vanishing Acts, Disc 9.
Fitz. It takes only a week in Arizona to turn me into a professional liar. When my editor calls, asking me for something about the Hopkins trial, I let my voicemail pick up until my mailbox is full. When she finally wises up and calls me in the middle of the night on my hotel phone to say that I have 6 hours to produce a story or lose my assignment, I tell her that I'll have it on her desk. Then, I email her and say that motions were filed in the case that kept me in court all day, and beg an extension. When a second week goes by, and I have produced absolutely nothing, Marge tells me to come back home to New Hampshire and earn my paycheck. She assigns me a piece about army engineers who have discovered a composite compound to prevent frost heaves, a topic that lets me clearly know I have been demoted in her mind. I tell her I'll be on the first flight out. I don't leave Phoenix. Instead, I sit down and fabricate a piece about the Army Corps of Engineers, and asphalt, and spring thaw, and water tables. I decide that since it will be buried in the middle of the paper anyway, fudging it a bit, okay, completely, isn't awful. Before I know it, this lying jag of mine has spread like maple syrup into all other venues of my life, sticky and somehow impossible to clean up. I call the owners of the pizza place I live above and say there has been a death in my family. Would they be kind enough to give an extension on my rent check? I phone the office and explain that I can't make the Monday meeting because I have a respiratory virus, something SARS-like and highly contagious. I let Sophie weave me a crown of Indian paintbrush, and when she asks when we are going home, I tell her, soon. When Delia leans on me, I tell myself I'd do the same for any old friend. That's the crazy thing about lies. You start to fall for them yourself. Every journalist wants a Death Row exclusive. You want to be the voice of truth that is heard. You want to be the megaphone through which the penitent's words are carried. You want the reader to listen to the inmate and think, maybe we are not all that different. But not every journalist knows that his exposé will break the heart of the woman he loves. When Andrew walks in, thinner than I remember him being, and with a badly shaved head, everything stops for me. Seeing him in his stripes is a little embarrassing, like catching your grandfather in his boxer shorts, a vision that you wish, the very moment you see it, that you never had. He seems so completely different from the man I used to know, as if this is a distant cousin with similar features arranged in an entirely new way. I wonder which came first, this Andrew or the other. I'm surprised that he's agreed to see me, if you want to know the truth. In spite of the fact that I practically grew up in his living room, Andrew knows that I write for the Gazette. He picks up the handset. I do the same. What I want to ask Andrew, as he stares at me through this sheer wall, is why he did it. What I say instead is, I hope you didn't have to pay a lot for the haircut. When he starts to laugh, I can see it for just a glimmer of a second. The man I used to know. My defining memory of Andrew involves communicating. Delia and Eric and I had been poking around an old dump site in the woods for pottery shards and Indian arrowheads and elixir bottles when we stumbled upon an ancient suitcase. Opening it, we discovered what seemed to be spy equipment, headphones and a switchboard and a frequency meter, with the wires torn out of the back and the speakers falling off the seams. It was too big for us to carry home, but we desperately wanted it. And a fast vote decided that of all of our parents, the only one who seemed remotely likely to help us with it was Andrew. That's a ham radio, he told us when he cracked open the suitcase. Let's see if we can get it to work. Andrew asked around at the senior center. Some of the old-timers remembered that particular brand and what knobs and buttons controlled volume and frequency. He took us with him to the library to get electronics books, to the hardware store to get wire and clamps, and to the basement, while he tinkered. One day, with the three of us clustered beside him, he turned on the radio. A high, dizzy whine came out of the speakers while he fiddled and spoke into the microphone. He had to repeat his message twice, but then, to our shock and delight, someone answered. Someone in England. The thing about a ham radio, he told us, is that you could always find someone to talk to. But you had to be careful, he warned, about giving away too much information about yourself. People were not always who they seemed to be. Andrew, I say to him now, did you really think you'd get away with it? He rubs his palms over the knees of his pants. Is this on or off the record? You tell me, I say. Andrew bows his head. Fitz, he confesses. I wasn't thinking at all. While I'm trapped in the desert, waiting for Delia and her wonder dog to find me underneath a Palo Verde tree, I look at the parched throat of this cracked earth and imagine all the ways a man might die. Naturally, the first one to come to mind is thirst. Having finished my token bottle of water an hour ago, and finding myself in the beating heat of this dry desert, I imagine dehydrating to the point of delirium. The tongue would swell like cotton batting, the lids of the eyes would stick. More preferable, now anyway, would be drowning. Must be a nasty fight at first, all that fluid going where it shouldn't. But at present, the thought of water, extra water, is really just too enticing. I wonder what it would be like at the end, if mermaids came to string your neck with shells and give you open-mouthed kisses. If you just lie down on the sand and watch the sun shimmy a million leagues away. Suffocation, hanging, a gunshot wound, all of these are too damn painful. But cold. I've heard that's sort of a nice way to go. To lie down in snow and go numb at this moment would be nothing short of a miracle. And then, of course, there is martyrdom, which I'm approaching at a damn fast rate. I'm burning, after all, even if it's not for my convictions. Does flesh charring off at the bone hurt less when you know you're right, even though everyone thinks you are wrong? That line of reasoning leads me right to Andrew. And then, it's a fast beeline to thinking of Delia. I don't think anyone has ever died of unrequited love. I wonder if I'll be the first. After we ring the doorbell, I squeeze Delia's hand. Are you sure you're ready for this? I ask. No, she says. Delia smooths Sophie's hair and adjusts the collar on her shirt until she twists around, shrugging off her mother's touch. Does this lady have kids? Sophie asks. Delia hesitates. No, she says. Elise Vasquez opens the door and drinks in Delia. There's really no other way to describe it. I have a sudden recollection of Delia in the hospital bed after she delivered Sophie, when the world had shrunk small enough to only hold the two of them. I guess it's like this for every mother and child. Someone who doesn't know Delia as well as I do would not notice the little flicky thing she is doing with her left hand, a nervous habit. Hi, she says. I thought maybe we could try this again. But Elise is staring at Sophie as if she's seen a ghost. And of course, that's exactly what Sophie is. A little girl who looks considerably like the one Elise Vasquez lost. This is Sophie, Delia introduces. And so, this is... When she gets to the spot where she should fill in the blank, her cheeks burn, and she says nothing at all. Call me Elise, Delia's mother says, and she squats down to smile into her granddaughter's eyes. Elise has shiny dark hair twisted into a knot at the base of her neck, and a fine graph of lines at the corners of her eyes and mouth. She's wearing a peasant shirt embroidered with colorful birds and jeans covered with Sharpie marker lines of text. My eyes focus on one. O daughter of ashes and mother of blood. Sandberg, I murmur. Elise looks up at me, impressed. Not many people read poetry these days. Fitz is a writer, Delia says. Actually, I'm a hack for a second-rate paper. Elise traces the phrase on her jeans. I always thought it would be wonderful to be a writer, she says. To know just like that how to put the right words together. I smile politely. The truth is, if I do miraculously manage to put the right words together, it's by default, because I've already used up all the wrong ones. And when you get right down to it, what I don't say is probably more important than what I do. Then again, maybe Elise Vasquez already knows this. She stares out the sliding glass door into the backyard, where Victor has taken Sophie to see a bird's nest, where the eggs are hatching. He lifts her up so she can get a closer look, and then they disappear behind a wall of cacti. Thank you, Elise says, for bringing her. Delia turns to her. I won't keep you from seeing Sophie. Elise glances at me uncomfortably. He's my best friend, Delia says. He knows about all of it. Just then, Sophie comes running back inside. It's so cool! They have teeth on their beaks, she says breathlessly. Can we stay until they come out? Sophie tugs on Delia's hand until she stands up. In the doorway, Victor chuckles. I tried to explain that it might take a while, he says. Delia answers him, but she is looking at her mother. That's all right, she says. I don't mind waiting. She lets Sophie pull her outside, toward the tree. Elise Vasquez and I stand, shoulder to shoulder, watching the woman we both feel we lost, and maybe never really had. On the way home, we stop for coffee. Sophie squats on the sidewalk at the cafe, drawing a crime scene outline around Greta with colored chalk. Delia drums her fingers on the edge of her cup, but doesn't seem to be inclined to drink anything from it. Can you picture them together? She asks finally, when the wheels of her mind have stopped turning. Elise and Victor? No, Delia says. Elise and my father. D. No one can ever imagine their parents doing it. Take mine, for example. The sad fact is my parents didn't do it. They managed to have me, of course, but most of the time I was growing up, my salesman father was off screwing a flight attendant in another city, and my mother was furiously busy pretending he wasn't. But my father was not Andrew Hopkins. In all the years I've known Delia, I can't remember him dating anyone seriously, so I can't even fathom what he'd look for in a woman. If you asked me, though, I'd never have imagined him falling for someone like Elise. She reminds me of an orchid, exotic and fragile. Andrew is more like ragweed, stealthy, resilient, stronger than you think. I look at the comma curve of Delia's neck, at the bony points of her shoulder blades, a terrain that has been mapped by Eric. Some people aren't meant to be together, I say. Suddenly, a ragged man wearing a hairnet and flip-flops walks toward us, holding a stack of pamphlets. Sophie, scared, hides behind her mother's chair. My brother, the vagrant asks me, have you found the Lord Jesus Christ? I didn't know he was looking for me. Is he your personal savior? You know, I say, I'm still kind of hoping to rescue myself. The man shakes his head, dreadlocks like snakes. None of us are strong enough for that, he replies, and moves on. I think that's illegal, I mutter to Delia. Or at least it should be. Nobody should have to swallow religion with their coffee. When I look up, she's staring at me. How come you don't believe in God? Delia asks. How come you do? She looks down at Sophie, and her whole face softens. I guess it's because some things are too incredible for people to take all the credit. Or the blame, I think. Two tables over, the zealot approaches an elderly couple. "Believe in the Father," he preaches. Delia turns in his direction. "It's never that simple," she says. When Delia was pregnant with Sophie, I was the labor coach. I sort of fell into it by default when Eric, who had promised that he wouldn't fuck up this time, wound up drying out just about the time Lamaze classes started. I found myself sitting in a circle of married couples, trying not to let my heart race as the nurse instructed me to settle Delia between my legs and trace my hands over the swell of her belly. Delia went into labor in the middle of the frozen foods aisle at Shaw's Market, and she phoned me from the manager's office. By the time we got to the hospital, I had worked myself into a near panic about how I would be able to do whatever it was that I was supposed to do as a labor coach without having to look between her legs. Maybe I could request a position at her shoulders. Maybe I could pull the doctor aside and explain the logistics of the situation. As it happened, I didn't have to worry about that at all. The minute the anesthesiologist rolled Delia onto her hip to insert the epidural, I took one look at the needle, passed out, and wound up with 60 stitches at my hairline. I awakened on a cot next to her. "Hey, cowboy," she said, smiling over the tiny peach of a head that poked out from the blanket in her arms. "Thanks for all the help." "Don't mention it," I said, wincing as my scalp throbbed. 60 stitches, Delia explained. And then she added, "I only had 10. I found myself looking at her head. "Not there," she said, giving me a moment to figure it out. "You're not going to pass out again, are you?" I didn't. Instead, I managed to lurch to the edge of Delia's hospital bed so that I could take a look at the baby. I remember looking into the fuzzy blue of Sophie's eyes and marveling at the fact that there was now one other person in this world who understood what it was like to be completely surrounded by Delia, who'd already learned that it couldn't stay that way. I had Sophie in my arms when Eric came in. He went straight to Delia and kissed her on the mouth, then bent his forehead against hers for a moment, as if whatever he was thinking might be transferred by osmosis. Then Eric turned, his eyes locking on his daughter. "You can hold her," Delia prompted. But Eric didn't make any move to take Sophie from me. I took a step toward him and saw what Delia must have overlooked. Eric's hands were shaking so hard that he had buried them in his coat pockets. I pushed the baby against his chest so that he'd have no choice but to grab hold. "It's okay," I said under my breath. To Eric? To Sophie? To myself? And as I transferred this tiny prize to Eric's arms, I held on longer than I had to. I made damn sure he was steady before I let go. I have 17 messages, all from my editor. The first starts by asking me to call her back. By the third, Marge is demanding it. Message 11 reminds me that if monkeys can be sent into space, they can certainly be trained to write for the New Hampshire Gazette. In the last voicemail, Marge tells me that if I don't have something on her desk by 9 a.m., she is going to fill my page space with the Xeroxes of my ass that I took at the office Christmas party. So, I pull down the shades in the motel. I turn up the TV to drown out the moans of a couple one thin wall away from me. I crank up the air conditioning. "Andrew Hopkins," I type, "is not what you expect when you walk through the corridors of the Madison Street Jail." I shake my head and hit the delete button, erasing the paragraph. Like any father, all Andrew Hopkins wants to talk about is his daughter. That sentence, I backspace into oblivion. Andrew Hopkins has ghosts in his eyes, I write, and then think, we all do. I pace around the island of the bed. Who wouldn't jump at the chance to change something about his life? 200 more points on an SAT, a Pulitzer, a Heisman, a Nobel, a more handsome face, a thinner body, a few more years with the babies that grew up when you had forgotten to pay attention, 5 more minutes with a loved one who has died. The moment I would do over is the one I've never been brave enough to have. I'd tell Delia how much I love her, and she would look at me the way she has always looked at Eric. What I want to write, what I need to write, is not what the New Hampshire Gazette is paying me for. Sitting down at my laptop, I erase what I've written. I start fresh.
Part 6. From The Exposed Nest by Robert Frost. Why is there then no more to tell? We turned to other things. I haven't any memory, have you, of ever coming to the place again? Eric. Chris Hamilton's paralegal spends 3 days trying to trace the current whereabouts of the neighbors who used to live next door to Elise and Andrew 28 years ago. She sticks her head in the door of the conference room shortly after lunchtime. Want the good news or bad news? I look up over the stack of papers I'm wading through. There's actually good news? Well, no, but I thought I'd make you feel better. What's the bad news? Alice Young, she says. I found her. Alice Young was a teenager who lived with her parents next door to Elise and Andrew. At one point, she had babysat for Delia. And? She's in Vienna. Good, I say. Subpoena her. Might want to rethink that? She lives with the Sisters of the Order of the Bloody Cross. She's a nun? She's a nun who took a vow of silence 10 years ago, the paralegal says. For Christ's sake. Exactly. However, I did manage to find the other neighbor, Elizabeth Peschman. She's at some place called Sunset Acres. I assume it's a retirement community. I take the information. Did you call? No one answers, she says. It's a Sun City, Arizona address. It can't be that far away. I'll go find her. It takes me 2 hours to reach the town, and there are so many retirement communities I wonder how I'll ever find the right one. However, the clerk who sells me gas in a Snickers bar knows the name right away. Two lights and then a left, you'll see the sign, she says as she rings me up. From the looks of things, Sunset Acres is not a bad place to finish up one's life. It's a turn off the main drag, a long drive lined with saguaros and desert rock gardens. I have to stop at a stucco guard booth. Apparently these seniors value their privacy. The man inside is stooped and age-spotted and looks like he could be a resident himself. Hi, I say. I'm trying to find Elizabeth Peschman. I tried to call. Lines down, the guard says. He points to a small parking lot. No cars allowed. I'll take you up. As I walk beside the guard, I wonder what sort of facility wouldn't allow cars up to the main building. It seems like quite an inconvenience, given the fact that some of the residents have to be arthritic or even disabled. As soon as we crest the hill, the guard points. Third from the left, he says. There are acres of crosses and stars and rose quartz obelisks. Our dear mother, reads one tombstone. Never forgotten, doting husband. Elizabeth Peschman is dead. I have no witness to corroborate the fact that 30 years ago, Elise Matthews was the drunk that Andrew says she was. Guess you're not talking either, I say out loud. Although it's beastly hot, there are fresh flowers wilting in pots beside Elizabeth's tombstone. She's real popular, the guard says. There are some folks here who never get visitors, but this one, she gets calls from a bunch of old students. She was a teacher? I ask, and my mind catches on the word. A teacher. You get what you need? The guard asks. I think so, I say, and I hurry back to my car. Abigail Nguyen is mixing paste when I arrive. A slight woman, with two knots of hair at the top of her head, like the ears of a bear, she looks up and gives me a smile. You must be Mr. Talcott, she says. Come on in. When the preschool where Delia went closed down in the mid-80s, Abigail started her own Montessori classes in the basement of a church. She was the third school listed in the Yellow Pages, and she'd answered the phone herself. We sit down, giants on miniature chairs. Ms. Nguyen, I'm an attorney, and I'm working on behalf of a girl you taught in the late 1970s. Bethany Matthews? The one who was kidnapped. I shift a little. Well, that hasn't been determined yet. I'm representing her father. I've been following it all in the papers and on the local news, as has the rest of Phoenix. I wonder, Mrs. Nguyen, if you might be able to tell me about Bethany back then. She was a good child, quiet, tended to work by herself instead of with her peers. Did you get a chance to know her parents? The teacher glances away for a moment. Sometimes Bethany came to school disheveled or wearing dirty clothes. It raised a red flag for us. I think I even called the mother. What was her name again? Elise Matthews. Yes, that's right. What did Elise say when you called? I can't remember, Mrs. Nguyen says. Do you recall anything else about Elise Matthews? The teacher nods. I assume you mean the fact that she smelled like a distillery. I feel my blood flow faster. Did you report her to Child Protective Services? The teacher stiffens. There weren't any signs of abuse. You said she came to school disheveled. There's a big difference between a child not being bathed every night and parental neglect, Mr. Talcott. It's not our job to police what happens at home. Take it from me. I've seen children burned on the soles of their feet by their parents' cigarettes, and I've seen children come to school with broken bones and welts on their backs. I've seen children who hide in the supply closet at pickup time because they don't want to go home. Mrs. Matthews might have liked her afternoon cocktail, but she deeply loved her little girl, and Bethany clearly knew that. You'd be surprised, I think. Mrs. Nguyen, thank you for your time. I hand her my card with Chris Hamilton's office number penciled in. If you think of anything else, please call me. I've just started my car in the parking lot when there's a knock on the window. Mrs. Nguyen stands with her arms folded. There was one incident, she says when I roll down the window. Mrs. Matthews was late to pick up. We called the house and kept calling, and there was no answer. I let Bethany stay for the afternoon session of school, and then I drove her home. The mother was passed out on the couch when we got there. So I took her home with me and let her stay the night. The next day, Mrs. Matthews apologized profusely. Why didn't you call Bethany's father? A breeze blows a strand of Mrs. Nguyen's hair from her bun. The parents were going through a divorce. A week before, the mother had specifically asked us not to allow her husband to have any contact with the child. How come? Some threat he made, if I remember right, Mrs. Nguyen says. She had reason to believe that he might take Bethany and run. Andrew looks thinner, although that might just be the baggy prison uniform. How's Delia? He asks, like always, but this time I don't answer. My patience is wound too tight. I stand with my hands in my pockets. You told me that the kidnapping of your child was a spur-of-the-moment thing, a knee-jerk reaction to a bad situation. You told me that when you went home to get Delia's blanket, you saw your ex-wife passed out and knew it was time to take matters into your own hands. Did I get that right? Andrew nods. Then how do you explain the fact that you threatened to take your daughter away from your wife before you actually did it? Frustrated, I kick a chair so that it spins across the tiny conference room. What else aren't you telling me, Andrew? Muscles tighten along the column of Andrew's throat, but he doesn't answer. I can't do this alone, I say, and I walk out of the room without looking back. 30 days before Andrew's trial, the state notices up its witnesses. I respond like I always do, by requesting the criminal records of everyone the prosecutor plans to call to the stand. This is basic defense law for those who have no defense. Do what you can to shoot holes in anything and everything the state throws your way. I get the records in the mail as I'm running out the door to the courthouse for a 404B hearing that Emma Wasserstein scheduled. Waiting for the judge to receive me in chambers, I open the envelope. Delia doesn't have a record, of course, so there are only 2 criminal record printouts. It's not much of a surprise to find a clean report for Detective LeGrand, the retired policeman who'd once been in charge of the kidnapping case. It's the second report that interests me anyway, the one for Elise Vasquez. Delia's mother was busted on a DWI charge after a car accident in 1972. It's a felony. It happened when she was pregnant with Dee. It's not going to be easy, but I'm sure as hell going to try to impeach Elise with that conviction on the witness stand. It's a credibility argument. If someone's been drinking chronically, his or her memory recall is even more suspect. I ought to know. Emma Wasserstein turns the corner and comes to a halt when she sees me outside the judge's chambers. He's not ready yet? I glance at her prodigious belly. Unlike you, I say. Apparently not. She rolls her eyes. Maybe you didn't get the memo, but we aren't in 7th grade anymore. The door opens and Judge Noble's assistant lets us into chambers. Very cranky, she warns under her breath. Someone hasn't had his protein today. We retreat to our seats and wait for Judge Noble to let us know it's all right to speak. Ms. Wasserstein, he sighs, what is it this time? Your Honor, I'd like to have a prior bad act admitted as evidence, namely, the assault conviction of Charles Matthews in December of 1976. It goes to motive. Judge, that's completely prejudicial, I say. We're talking about a scuffle years ago, one which is completely irrelevant to the charge at hand. Irrelevant? Emma stares at me. Did you happen to notice whom your client was beating up at the time? She hands me a copy of the old assault charge, the same one I skimmed when I got it during discovery, figuring it had nothing to do with this case. My eyes hone in on the victim's name. Victor Vasquez. 6 months before Andrew absconded with his daughter and 3 months before his divorce, he beat up the man who would later marry his ex-wife, which actually does go toward motive, namely revenge, if your wife is screwing around with a guy before you're even out the door. The judge gathers the papers on his desk into their file. I'm going to allow it, he says. Is there anything else, counselor? Emma nods. Your Honor, I think it's clear to all of us that Mr. Talcott hasn't noticed up a formal necessity defense. That leads me to believe that he's going to run this trial as an all-out slander of Elise Vasquez. It's exactly what I'm planning to do. I'd like to say on the record that I truly hope this doesn't turn into a smear campaign of the victim, just because counsel doesn't have anything redeeming to say about his own client. The judge fixes his gaze on me. Mr. Talcott,
I don't know if they allow character assassination in the courtrooms of New Hampshire, but you can be assured that we certainly don't allow it here in Arizona.
Regular assassination, though, would be a different story, I murmur under my breath.
What was that?
The judge asks. Nothing, Your Honor. Andrew is guilty as hell of kidnapping, but there must be ways around that. It's the way defense law works. You always plead not guilty when what you really mean is guilty, but with good reason. Then you talk to your client and he gives you details from his sorry life that will win the sympathy of the jury. Assuming, that is, that those details from your client's sorry life don't thwart you at every turn. I think back to what the nursery school teacher said about Andrew threatening to take his daughter, to Emma's smug expression when she handed me Andrew's old assault charge. What else hasn't he told me that might screw this case up even more?
You've got 30 days to pull a rabbit out of a hat, counselor, Judge Noble says. Why are you still standing here?
When Andrew walks into our private conference room at the jail, I glance up. Let's add this to the list of things you ought to mention to your attorney, who is trying his best to get you acquitted, that your prior conviction for a bar fight just happened to involve your wife's future husband. He glances up, surprised. I thought you knew. It was right there on the record at the arraignment. You feel like enlightening me any further? He stares at me for a long moment. I saw him, he confesses, his voice cracking. I watched him touching her. Elise? Slowly, Andrew nods. How did you find out there was something going on? Delia had drawn a crayon picture for me on a piece of scrap paper. I was hanging it up in my office at the pharmacy when I happened to notice there was writing on the back. I thought it might be something important, so I turned it over. It was a letter Elise had been writing to someone named Victor. I was still married to her. I loved her. He swallows. When I asked Dee where she got the paper from, she said the drawer next to Mommy's bed. And when I asked her if she knew anyone named Victor, she said he was the man who came over to take a nap with Mommy. Andrew gets up and walks toward the door with its tiny streaked window. She was in the house. She was only a baby. He stands with his hands on his hips. I came home early from work one day, on purpose, and caught them together. And you messed him up so bad he needed 65 stitches. I say, Emma Wasserstein is going to use that whole episode to explain why you turned around and kidnapped your daughter 6 months later. She's going to say it was a premeditated act of payback. Maybe it was. Andrew murmurs.
Do not say that on the stand, for God's sake.
He rounds on me.
Then you make up the story, Eric. Give me a goddamned script and I'll say whatever you want.
It would be enough, I realize, for any defense attorney. A client willing to do whatever I say. But it's different this time, because no matter what facade I build over the truth, we'll both know there's something hiding underneath. Andrew doesn't want to tell me more, and suddenly I don't want to hear it. So I pick 3 words from the quicksand between us. Andrew, I say heavily, I quit. Fitz is trying to make fire. He's put his glasses down on the dusty ground and has positioned them in direct line with the sun to see if they'll ignite the crumpled ball of paper underneath the rims. What are you doing? I ask, unraveling my tie as I approach the trailer.
Exploring pyromania, he says.
Why?
Because I can.
He squints up at the sun, then moves the glasses a fraction to the left.
I told Andrew I quit, I announce.
Fitz rocks back on his heels.
Why'd you do that?
Glancing down at his combustion experiment, I say, "Because I can." "No, you can't," he argues. "You can't do that to Delia." I don't think it's healthy to have a spouse who looks at you and thinks, "Oh, right, he's the guy who got my father locked away for 10 years. Don't you think it's going to hurt her more when she finds this out? "I don't know, Fitz," I say pointedly, thinking that this is the pot calling the kettle black. "Maybe she'll find out what you're doing first." "Find out what?" Delia says, coming out of the trailer. She looks from me to Fitz. "What are you doing?" "Trying to talk your fiancé out of being an asshole." I scowl at him. "Just mind your own business, Fitz." "Aren't you going to tell her?" he challenges. "Sure," I say. "Fitz is writing about the trial for his paper." Immediately, I feel like a jerk. Delia steps back. "Really?" she says, wounded. Fitz is red-faced, furious. "Why don't you ask Eric what he did today?" I've had it. First the hearing in chambers, then the argument with Andrew, and now this. I tackle Fitz to the ground, knocking his glasses to the side as we scuffle on the dirt. Fitz has gotten stronger since the last time we've done this, which must have been ages ago. He grinds my face into the pebbles, his hand locked on the back of my neck. With a jab of my elbow in his gut, I manage to get the upper hand, and then my cell phone begins to ring. It reminds me that, in spite of how I'm acting, I'm not some stupid adolescent anymore. I frown at the unfamiliar number. "Talcott," I answer. "This is Emma Wasserstein. I wanted to let you know that I'll be adding a witness to my list. The man's name is Rubio Greengate. He's the guy who sold your client two identities back in 1977. I walk around to the back of the trailer so that Delia won't hear. "You can't spring this on me now," I say, incredulous. "I'll object when you file the motion." "I'm not springing anything on you. You've got 2 weeks. I'll have the police reports of the interview we've done with him on your desk by tomorrow morning." This means that the prosecution has established a witness to tie Andrew to the abduction. And for reasons I've never understood, juries hang on the words of witnesses, even when their accounts aren't accurate. I open my mouth to tell Emma that I could actually care less, that I'm excusing myself from this case starting immediately. But instead, I only hang up the phone and walk back to where Delia is now standing alone. She looks like she's been stung, like she's still smarting. And why shouldn't she? It's not every day you find out that someone you trust has been lying behind your back. For Delia, this is becoming commonplace. "I told Fitz to go to hell," she says quietly. "I said he could quote me on that in 20-point type." She turns to me. "I should have realized that if he came all the way out here, it was because he had an agenda." "For what it's worth," I say, "I don't think he wanted to write this story any more than you want to see it written." "I told him things I haven't even told you. God, Eric, I took him with me the last time I went to see my mother." She pushes her hair off her face. "What else is wrong?" "What do you mean?" "Fitz said you had something to tell me. Is there something wrong with my father's case?" She is staring at me with those beautiful brown eyes, the same ones I remember from 1,000 moments in my life. The summer Sunday, when I showed off by jumping off the high dive at the town pool. The February vacation, when I broke my leg skiing. The night I made love to her for the first time. To the left of her foot, the paper that had been beside Fitz's glasses bursts into flame. "There's nothing wrong with his case," I lie. And I don't tell her that I'm giving up either. Nighttime in Arizona is an embarrassment of riches. Sophie and I sit on the roof of the trailer, wrapped in a blanket. I show Sophie the Big Dipper, an Orion's belt, and a winking red star. She's more interested, though, in locating the alphabet. Just this morning, I found one of my depositions on the kitchen table covered with multiple streams of the letter B.
Daddy, she says, pointing, I see a W.
Good for you.
There's another W, too.
The moon is full tonight, and when Sophie points it out, I can clearly see the trio. W-O-W. To my surprise, when I spell out the letters, she tells me what the word is.
Ruth Ann taught me, Sophie says. I know wow and cat and dog and yes.
As she settles back in the V of my legs, I realize that if someone stole Sophie away from me, even if that person was Delia, I would search for her forever. I would turn over every single star, if that's what it took to find her. But by the same token, if I knew that someone was going to steal her away from me, I guarantee you that I'd take her first and run. Suddenly, Sophie stands up and bends over, so that her head is between her legs. She looks up at the sky from this vantage point while I panic about her falling off the top of the trailer.
Did you know, she says, that wow upside down is mom?
I guess I never noticed. Sophie leans against my heart.
I think it's like that on purpose, she says.
Sometime after midnight, Delia climbs up to the roof of the trailer and sits down cross-legged behind me.
My father's going to go to jail, isn't he? She says.
I gently lay Sophie down on a bed of blankets. She's fallen asleep against me. You can't ever tell in a jury trial.
Eric.
I duck my head. There's a good chance. She closes her eyes.
For how long?
A maximum of 10 years.
In Arizona?
I slip my arm around her.
Let's deal with that when and if it happens.
With the moon watching like a hawk, I run my hands over the river of her hair and the landscape of her shoulders. We slip into my sleeping bag together, a tight fit, and she slides over me, her legs pressed the length of mine and her skin slick. We are attentive to silence. Sophie is asleep a few feet away, and that changes the tenor of the act. Without words, the other sensations expand. Sex becomes desperate, secret, precise as a ballet. We move while coyotes pace the desert and snakes write in code across the sand. We move while the stars rain down on us like sparks. We move and her body blooms. Then we turn onto our side, still linked, too close for anything to come between us.
I love you,
I whisper against her skin. My words fall into the tiny divot at the base of her throat, the pockmark left behind after a sledding accident. But Delia has had that mark ever since I met her at age 4. The sledding accident would have occurred beforehand, when she was living in Phoenix, where it doesn't snow. D, I say urgently, but she's already asleep. That night I dream of running on the surface of the moon, where everything weighs less, even doubt. Andrew enters the private attorney-client conference room.
I thought you quit.
That was yesterday, I reply. Listen, that scar on Delia's neck, it didn't come from a sledding accident, did it?
No. It was a scorpion sting.
She was stung by a scorpion on her throat?
She got stung on the shoulder, but by the time Elise found her, she was already in bad shape. At the hospital, they tried to intubate her, but couldn't do it the regular way, so they cut a hole in her windpipe and put her on a ventilator for 3 days until she could breathe on her own again.
What hospital did you bring her to?
Scottsdale Baptist, Andrew says.
If Delia had been brought into a hospital in 1976 for a scorpion bite, there will be records. Written proof that in her mother's solitary care, this child had been harmed. If it happened once, there was every chance it would happen again.
And that might be enough justification for a jury to understand why a protective father might run off with his little girl. I gather up my papers until Andrew I'll be in touch. Then I race into the parking lot behind the jail, where I turn the air conditioner on full blast and call Delia on my cell phone. "Guess what?" I say when she answers. "I think I know why you're afraid of bugs."
Scottsdale Baptist Hospital is now Scottsdale Osborne. An administrative assistant who's been following the kidnapping on local news channels has given Delia her old hospital records in return for an autograph. We sit down together in an archive closet, surrounded by walls of files with the colorful confetti of routing tabs. Delia opens the folder, and the musty scent of the past rises up from the small stack of paperwork. I watch her scan the pages and wonder if she realizes she's fingering the dime-sized hollow at the base of her throat.
"You read it," she says a moment later, shoving the folder at me. Bethany Matthews, date of visit, 11/24/76. History. 3-year-old white female brought in by mother following questionable scorpion sting to left shoulder approximately 1 hour prior to admission. Patient complains of pain to left shoulder as well as difficulty breathing, nausea, and double vision. Mother reports patient has had intermittent jerking of her arms as well as 2 episodes of non-bloody, non-bilious emesis. No loss of consciousness, no chest pain, no bleeding. Past medical history, none. Allergies, no known drug allergies. Tetanus, up to date. Physical examination. 128/88, 177, 34, 99.8, 98% on RA 20 kilograms. Anxious, agitated 3-year-old, female, in moderate distress. Head, ear, eye, nose, throat. Horizontal nystagmus. Pupils equal, round and react to light and accommodation. Copious salivation, OP clear. Neck. Supple, non-tender. No LAD. No thyromegaly. Lungs. Slight ronchi bilaterally, slight increase. Work of breathing. No retractions. Cardiovascular. Regular tachycardia. No MRG. Abdomen. S/NT/ND/+BS. EXT. 2x3 area of erythema on posterior left shoulder. No ecchymosis. No bleeding. 2+ distal pulses × 4. Neuro. Alert. Anxious, horizontal nystagmus to left side. Disconjugate gaze. Facial droop on left side. Gag reflex not intact. 5/5 strength times 4 extremities. Sensitive to light touch, except at area around envenomation. Occasional pisthenos. Laboratory data. White blood cell count, 11/6. Hemoglobin count, -36. Platelets, 240. Sodium, 136. Potassium, 3.9. Chlorine, 100. HCO3, 24. BUN, 18. Chromium, 1.0. Glucose, 110. Calcium, 9.0. INR, 1.2. PTT, 33.0. Urinalysis, special growth, 1.020. 25/50 white blood cell count. 5/10 red blood cell count. 3+ BAC, 1+ SQEPI, plus nitrite, plus LE. ED decision making. Patient presented to ED with SS consistent with severe envenomation. After receiving 2 milligrams versed IV, the patient was initially improved, but became agitated when Dr. Young attempted to remove the patient's clothing in order to fully assess her.
Anti-venin was unavailable. Additional doses of Versed were ineffective, and the decision was made to sedate and paralyze the patient for intubation. Because of the copious secretions, orotracheal intubation was impossible, and a needle cricothyrotomy was performed successfully. The patient was then admitted to the PICU and underwent a subsequent tracheostomy by PEDS general surgery. Patient ventilated for 3 days. Urinalysis also revealed a urinary tract infection, and the PICU team has been notified of this finding.
I don't understand what it says, Delia murmurs. You couldn't breathe, I say, skimming the notes. So the doctors made a surgical opening in your throat and hooked you up to machines that breathed for you. I read further down the page. ED social worker was requested because mother presented as intoxicated. Father notified. Here is proof, in black and white, that medical professionals thought Elise Hopkins was so drunk she was unable to take care of her child. Delia turns to me. I can't believe I don't remember this. You were young, I justify. Shouldn't I have